Hi, this is Dr. Dan Potter with the University of Kentucky Department of Entomology. I'm delighted that you've been able to join me for this webcast on woody plants for urban bee conservation. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the contributions of Bernadette Bernie Mock, a newly minted PhD who conducted the research that I'll be talking about as part of her doctoral project with my assistance and also help from other members in my lab. The beautiful insect that we're looking at is the common Western or European honeybee, a remarkable pollinator. It's covered with furry branched hairs, which are terrific for trapping pollen. It can communicate the location of flowers to its nestmates, and it feeds its larvae on pollen and nectar. Humans have domesticated this honeybee for thousands of years, but it's by no means the only bee that's important in urban landscapes. In fact, there are more than 4,000 species of native bees that, together with honeybees, pollinate a great variety of native plants as well as, of course, many of our most important agricultural crops. Some of these bees are familiar to most people, like the common bumblebees, which buzz pollinate our tomato gardens. Others, like the little blue orchard bee, shown to the right of the slide, second from the bottom, are very important native bees for pollinating some of our apples and other fruit crops. And the beautiful metallic sweat bees that you see to the left are important for pollinating a lot of our native wildflowers. So bees are important, and they're important, of course, from the standpoint of agriculture. The majority of our major food crops are pollinated by insects, particularly bees. The value to American agriculture is enormous. In this graphic that you see at the top of the slide, you can see your diet on wind-pollinated plants and all of those delicious things, the cantaloupes and the apples, the lemons and the berries would be off the menu if it wasn't for the services of pollinators. We shouldn't forget that pollinators also come and visit our attractive woody ornamentals that we value for their beautiful fruit, things like our holly berries that decorate holiday tables at Christmas time. And these ornamental fruits form an important source of food for desirable wildlife like birds. And so bees really are keystone species in urban food chains. They also pollinate a lot of different types of wildflowers, and our urban surroundings would be much less beautiful if it wasn't for the bees. Perhaps you've heard that bees are declining, and the reasons why they're declining are complex. When it comes to honeybees, which are really domesticated livestock for the most part, the honeybees are declining through a combination of parasitic mites, exotic bee diseases, some stressful management practices, and in some cases, the accidental exposure to pesticides, along with other things. But native bees are declining too. This map shows one of the things that we're concerned about, and that is that bees are in decline all over North America. The areas with red are places where surveys and other research has indicated that native bees appear to be decreasing in abundance. So we can see that bees are in trouble. One of the reasons that the native bees are in trouble is loss of habitat and loss of food. Now, bees need food to get through the things that they have to do. The food for bees comes from flowers, at least most of it does. Flowers provide vital pollen and nectar. Pollen is a protein source for raising the larval bees, the baby bees, up to adulthood. And nectar, of course, contains carbohydrates and sugars, which are the fuel for the adult bees, kind of an energy drink for the adult bees. And without these floral resources, the bees really can't do the things that they need to do. We know that the best way to help urban bees is to give them more and better food. With our suburbanization and urbanization of the United States, unfortunately, with monoculture lawns and a lot of our horticulturally derived plants, the bees don't have as much food as they used to have back in the old days. So there's certainly a lot of interest in helping the bees by augmenting landscapes with flowering plants. The Million Pollinator Garden Challenge is a good example of this type of initiative, although that one focuses mainly on herbaceous plants. In an effort to help pollinators, there have been many resources published, books, pamphlets, and websites that list plants that are attractive to bees and other pollinators. These lists are useful and they're interesting, But the problem with these lists is that most of them are not firmly grounded in scientific data. They come from a compilation of different individuals' observations. And although they're useful, again, there's not necessarily a lot of scientific basis behind them. And in particular, these lists emphasize herbaceous plants, not woody plants. We know that a single tree or shrub can provide thousands of flowers with high-quality pollen and nectar, far more flowers per unit area than might be provided by herbaceous flowering plants that would be in just two dimensions. But there's very little scientific evidence about which woody plants attract which pollinators. Even the best of the lists, for example, those that are published by an organization called the Pollinator Partnership, often are lacking in detail. So we can see a portion of one of those lists where we can look, for example, at serviceberry, which is certainly a very good plant for attracting bees. But if we look in the column visitation by pollinators, we see only listed bees. We don't see what type or how many or how bee attractive it is compared to, say, a maple tree, the row above. So the project goal for this was to document which flowering woody plant species attract which bees, how many and what types of bees, to help guide the planting decisions of homeowners, land care managers, and also to help the horticultural industry to identify and then market plants that would be very good for urban bee conservation. So we were interested in surveying a large number of woody plant species and determining the numbers and types of bee visitors that come to them. In our survey, we sampled the bee assemblages associated with 72 different species of woody plants, looking at five separate sample sites for each plant species. This is by far the largest survey of bees associated with woody plants conducted anywhere in the world. We included a very large variety of woody plants, including native and non-native species, but we specifically excluded any plants that were listed as invasive or nuisance species by the USDA or by state governments in the southeastern or midwestern United States. Our survey was conducted in the Ohio Valley region, with most of the sample sites in central Kentucky, some extending into eastern southern Indiana, and also to the Cincinnati area, shown in the circle here. We visited many different types of urban planting sites. You can see we have our University of Kentucky football stadium in the upper left. We looked at municipal and institutional landscapes, cemeteries, street trees and along roadsides, arboreta, and many, many individual home landscapes. At each site, we started by comparing the plant's relative attractiveness to bees using time snapshot counts. This would be conducted by two observers who would observe and count the number of bees that were flying about and visiting the flowers of that particular plant over a given period of time. And then after the snapshot counts were done, we collected 50 bee samples from each of the five sites per plant species, as you can see here. In all, we collected and identified about 11,275 bees and identified all of them to the level of genus. The bee numbers and the diversity of bees were then compared between the different woody plant species. So what did we find out? Well, I'm going to elaborate on these points in just a moment, but in general, we found that different woody plants attract different bee communities and that flower form matters. Not all flowering woody plants attract bees, and some attract many more than others. We also found that native and non-native plants both attract diverse communities of bees, and I'll elaborate on that too in just a moment. So what did we find? Different woody plants attract different bee assemblages. You can see that through this pair of photographs where the flowering crabapple is attracting largely honeybees and some of the early season mining bees, whereas the fuzzy dutia, which blooms a little bit later in the summer, is dominated by bumblebees and carpenter bees. So perhaps if you've got a wooden garage and don't care for wood-boring bees, you might not want a fuzzy dutia right outside that garage. We found that different woody plants attract different numbers and species of bees. So you can see here graphically that a plant like eastern redbud that blooms relatively early in the growing season is attracting a very large number of early season active mining bees. And these bees are also very important for pollinating things like blueberries and some of our early season fruits. On the other hand, Hegan cherry, which is a non-native plant, is a real magnet for honeybees and bumblebees. You can see that through this thicker line that goes from the Hegan cherry to that bee group. PG hydrangea is very, very attractive to sweat bees, the little bees that pollinate so many of our wildflower species, and so on. Some woody plants attract very diverse bee assemblages, and others attract only a relatively few species. So on the left, we can see a native plant, in this case, mock orange or Philadelphus. And you can see that that bee assemblage is dominated by a single small species. That particular species is a resin-gathering bee that specializes on this particular plant. Whereas on the right, we see a non-native plant, chase tree, with a much more diverse bee assemblage consisting of at least five families of bees. So another major finding was that flower form matters, and I'd like to explain that for just a moment. Plants that have been horticulturally modified to have double petals or are covered with sterile sepals, such as the two that are at the bottom of this image, are not attracting very many bees at all. In fact, if you look at those flowers, you can see that the double petals and the sepals are largely masking or even replacing the floral parts that the bees are after, the pollen and nectar. On the other hand, the more open flowers like prairie rose and hydrangea paniculata are real bee magnets that make it easy for the bees to get at the floral resources. Another major finding of our survey was that native and non-native plants can both attract diverse communities of bees. And this touches on one of the most important controversies and debates in conservation biology, and that is whether non-native plants can play any role in biodiversity conservation. It's a commonly held belief that native plants are the best for bees, but is that always true? In our survey, we found that both native and non-native plants can attract either low or high numbers of bees. All of the plants you see in this slide are attractive to bees, but within each of the groups, native and non-native, there's a great deal of variation. For example, flowering dogwood attracts far fewer bees than another native plant, winged sumac. And among the non-natives, we can see that roughleaf dogwood, although it is bee attractive, is not that bee attractive, whereas Hegan cherry and BB tree are real bee magnets. We found overall that both native and non-native plants can attract diverse bee communities. So we see some of the best bee magnets on the left, eastern redbud, bottlebrush buckeye, devil's walking stick, all these are native plants, but the non-native plants shown on the right, seven sunflower, cornice moss, and chase tree, are just as attractive as the best native ones. One of the key questions we were interested in after finding out that non-native plants can be very bee attractive was whether or not the nectar and pollen provided by those plants might be junk food for bees. So the question was, do native woody plants provide higher quality floral resources than non-natives? And to answer that question, we collected nectar and pollen from a subset of bee-attractive native and non-native plants that were matched for their bloom dates. You can see in the image my graduate student, Bernie, using a very fine glass tube to collect the nectar from a holly flower. The samples of nectar and pollen were then analyzed for key nutrients, sugars and amino acids in particular. What we found was that although the nutrients in the pollen and nectar do vary by plant species, both native and non-native woody plants can provide high-quality food for bees and other pollinators. So something like a Virginia spirea, shown on the left, is a very good resource for bees. But on the right, we see a seven suns flower, which is a non-native Asian plant that blooms very late in the year, and it also provides high-quality pollen and nectar. You can see a monarch butterfly stopping by to take a sip of nectar from this exotic seven sunflower tree blossom on its way back to Mexico. So in summary, we found in this study that different woody plants attract different bee communities, and that the location of those plants matters as well. There was some variation among sites of, say, crabapple or redbud or the other plants as far as where they were located, and we don't fully understand the reasons why just yet. Flower form matters, and in general, plants that have doubled petals or that are covered with sterile sepals are less attractive and less valuable for bees than our plants that have open flowers, where the nectar and pollen are easily accessible. Finally, we found that native and non-native plants can both attract diverse communities of bees, and both can be valuable. So to build a bee-friendly landscape, we recommend planting a variety of verified bee-friendly plants, emphasizing native species, but mixing in some non-native plants so long as they're not invasive. The non-native plants can extend the flowering season and provide floral resources for bees when many of the native plants have either not bloomed yet or finished blooming. Many of the best bee magnets, and some of them are shown in this slide, are also underplanted species that can add variety and interest to landscapes, and that can be very attractive to consumers. Another key point is that many of the best bee magnet plants are also relatively pest-free. So even as an experienced entomologist, I'd be hard-pressed to name major or key pests on a lot of the plants that we found to be particularly useful and attractive to bees. And if we don't have a lot of pests on the plants, then we eliminate the need to spray them, and that can also be very valuable in urban bee conservation. Now, to build a bee-friendly landscape, we recommend planting a variety of trees and shrubs that bloom at different times during the growing season to provide bees with resources from early spring through the summer and on into the early autumn months. So plants such as carnelian cherry dogwood, a non-native plant, bloom very early as March, and they can provide honeybees and some of our early spring-active bees with the resources they need to get going. And then we have a lot of plants that bloom during the May and June window. A lot of the natives bloom during that time, like bottlebrush buckeye. And one of the reasons why some of the Asian trees are particularly valuable, things like seven sunflower tree, chase tree, or amarmakia, is that they bloom later in the growing season when most of the native plants are finished. And they can carry our bee populations through until the time when they go into overwintering. You can see in this slide the seven sunflower tree blossoms absolutely covered with late-season honeybees. So to build a bee-friendly landscape, we want to provide flowers throughout the seasons, and we can choose plants that bloom in the spring, early summer, and late summer to make sure that the bees have floral resources to get through their seasonal cycle and to be healthy and strong going into the wintertime. This study was funded in part by a grant from the Horticultural Research Institute, and the HRI has put together and published a really nice list of plants bees like best, which is based upon our research results. And you can see on the right that the plants are ranked by 1 to 4 stars, although all of the plants on the list are bee attractive. They've also put together lists of the plants that are the most attractive to bumblebees and honeybees. And that kind of information might be very interesting to people who are urban beekeepers. And this list is available online as a free download. And there's a link to this HRI Plants Bees Like Best list on your study guide. Knowledge of which plants are bee-friendly can also open new marketing opportunities for growers and retailers. For example, for garden centers that want to hold pollinator days, to focus on those types of plants that might be attractive to customers who want to plant bee-friendly landscapes, and also for growers who can now market their plants as being ones that are valuable for urban bee conservation. So I'd like to acknowledge the funding sources for the work that I presented today, which are shown here, and also give a shout out to Carolina Simeo for her hard work in putting together the slides that I used in this presentation, and also the study guide. This work was part of a large grant that involves people other than my own lab, and those people are listed here, and I want to thank them for their input and support to our work, and also the stakeholder advisory group that has provided a lot of excellent input to our project. And finally, I want to acknowledge these organizations that have provided funding to my program to help to support the Urban Bee Survey. And thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions, I'd be very happy to have you contact me via email. Thank you.